Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Nice and cozy. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. Beloved Jesus Christ. Blessed Master. Dearest Mother. Saints and sages of all religions. I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Wonderful to be here this morning. Wanted to read you something funny from Angela Victory. She sent down an anecdote about Aiden. And Angela's had some dreams concerning Papa and Aiden and some wonderful things. So she writes, "It's Aiden's bedtime, and we are going through all of the thank you, God, for fill in the blank, for things in the day that we are thankful for. I had a long list of this and that. He is listening and smiling. Then in his turn, he says thanks to God for his books and the scone he had at the market. Back to me now, and I am thanking for different people. Then I point to Swami Ram Dass' photo and say, thank you, God, for him. Aiden responds right away with, you're welcome, and I'm not God. With a big smile on his face. The interesting thing is he didn't respond to any of my thanks till I mentioned Swami Ram Dass. Interesting. Not delightful. What wonderful souls we have. And there we have interesting and wonderful children coming in through various ways. One little soul has taken it upon him that he's a missionary to his father, and his father's currently, as mother said, he's worshiping God in his absence. And so he's taken it on this little fellow to convert his dad. He's a missionary to him, and he's all the time talking to him about God and about Jesus and about the spiritual path and how God is in the grass and everything that you see. And his father just shakes his hand in bewilderment at this little boy who's out to convert him. This article from Financially Fit. And it's by Karen Kroll. Meet the Hildebrandts. 5 years ago, the Hildebrandt family of New Richmond, Wisconsin, was juggling more than $100,000 in credit card and personal debt. Through frugality, determination, and hard work, they are now, other than a mortgage, debt-free. At the time, Russell and Candy Hildebrandt's credit card balances totaled $89,000, and they owed $17,000 to a family member. While they were current on all their payments, the card companies had begun raising their interest rates, adding hundreds to their minimum monthly payments. Candy acknowledges that they presented a higher credit risk, given how their balances had ballooned. Even so, with the bump in the required payments, covering the monthly payments was a struggle. We had to change, Candy said. Change they did. For their debt-fighting prowess, the Hildebrandts were on Tuesday night named the winners of the Professional Achievement and Counseling Excellence 2009 Graduate Client of the Year Award. This national award, given by the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, recognizes the hard work and commitment they demonstrated in repaying their debts and their willingness to become effective managers of their money and change their lifestyle. Not that the Hildebrandt's lifestyle was lavish. The couple, along with their twin daughters, Heidi and Holly, lived in a rented 1,000-square-foot townhome. Vacations consisted of visits to extended family members in the Midwest. Russell was a chemist with a Twin Cities-based environmental testing laboratory. Candy was a stay-at-home mom and homeschooled their daughters. While the Hildebrandts weren't living extravagantly, they also weren't frugal, Candy notes. They purchased most items, such as clothes, for their girls new. In addition, they had medical expenses related to Russell's diabetes and several miscarriages that Candy suffered. At the same time, they remained committed to tithing, or giving 10% of their income to their church. The accumulation of day-to-day expenses left the family going into a bit more debt each year. Several family friends recommended that they file for bankruptcy. That was out of the question, Russell said. We were committed to paying off all of our debts. They also resolved to continue to tithe and homeschool their daughters. To get started, Candy met with Linda Humberg, a manager with Family Means Consumer Credit Counseling Service in Stillwater, Minnesota. Linda reviewed their finances and developed a 5-year debt management plan. While the schedule is daunting, the Hildebrandts signed on. If we didn't make it, we knew that we would go out trying, Russell said. Several steps were key to making the plan work. Candy and Russell eliminated discretionary spending. Candy began buying generic food and frequenting thrift stores for clothing purchases. They stopped exchanging gifts, Christmas and birthday gifts, with each other and their relatives. Even with the drastic cutbacks, the Hildebrandts couldn't cover the $2,000 they were sending each month for their bills to be distributed to their creditors. At the same time, the sum amounted to about half of Russell's take-home pay. So Russell took a second job cleaning a local grocery store several nights a week from midnight to 4:30 a.m. He would arrive home from his day job, eat dinner, catch a few hours of sleep, and head to work. After his shift, he would go back home, sleep a few more hours, and then get up for his day job. The first 2 years were particularly tough. Russell's work schedule is grueling, while Candy managed just about everything at home on her own. Moreover, while their credit card balances were going down, the drop wasn't yet noticeable. For about a year, the Hildebrandts made do with one car until they received a used van from Candy's family. Even so, they didn't let anything deter them from progress, Humberg says. If the family money wasn't available, they simply did without. Equally important, the Hildebrandts kept their goal, becoming debt-free, in mind. After the first few years, the Hildebrandts' efforts finally seemed to be bearing fruit. Their card balances were coming down, and some were getting paid off. As one card reached zero, CCCS would apply the money that had gone into the remaining balances. As a result, those cards would get paid off more quickly. About this time, Candy became pregnant with Joey, who is now 3. While recognizing a new child would mean additional expenses, the couple was thrilled. The joy he brought to a negative, grinding situation was the light we needed, she says. By the fall of 2008, the Hildebrandts had 1 year to go on payment plan. Russell even started daydreaming about a new home when he saw a 3-bedroom Rambler for sale in New Richmond. It had all they were looking for, including a large yard and a separate bedroom for Joey. Russell let a real estate agent know that he liked the house, but added that the family would have to pay off their debts before taking on a mortgage. Several months later, the agent called and asked if the Hildebrandts would be interested in a rent-to-own agreement. The current owner of the house had some health concerns and was eager to move. The monthly rent would be $1,000, which included $200 to be escrowed for closing costs. They could manage it. Earlier this year, the owner wanted to accelerate the sale process. In April, using tax credit for the first-time homebuyers, the Hildebrandts were able to swing the purchase and pay off the remaining balances on their credit cards about 6 months ahead of schedule. Now the Hildebrands are content in their new home and free of debt other than the mortgage. Russell had been able to quit his second job and spend more time with his family and catch up on sleep. Several things haven't changed, however. Candy remains a dedicated bargain hunter. Shopping online, she found 8 bar stools for their kitchen island and basement family room for $24. At a yard sale, she bought a $2 desk for the girls. The Hildebrands had to completely rethink how they spent and what was a need versus a want, Humberg says. Both Russell and Candy say that while bankruptcy might have seemed like an easier option at the outset, it would not have been as satisfying. They wouldn't have learned to take control of their money and spending. What's more, with the bankruptcy on their credit record, they wouldn't have been able to purchase a house when they did. Their advice to others? Get out of debt, Candy says. It's a chokehold. I think that's a wonderful example of people and their determination to get their financial records right. It's an interesting thing. At one time in this world, you might go to debtor's prison, and people actually went into a prison where they could remain and when they owed large sums, and how they were supposed to repay their sums when they were in prison is a little bit beyond logic, I think. But nevertheless, that happened. And today we don't have that kind of debtor's prison, but there is a prison that happens when we have debt. It's a weight that weighs upon us. It's something that when we go into debt, we borrow against the future, our future earnings. And so we're indebted to our future, and not only does it diminish what we have in the present, but into the future it also, and then you add interest to it, and it takes away from our future, not to mention the worry that comes with it. So the idea of going by cash, not going into debt, and then reserving money aside is something that we should all aspire to. And when you have some money set aside, then you have a sense of a little bit of space, that if something happens to your job or to you, that you're not completely up against the wall. As householder yogis, we don't necessarily live as swamis do or as sadhus do, who wander the world without anything at all, that there is a certain responsibility that we have when we live in this world. And so to have this proper relationship with Caesar, as Jesus said, render unto Caesar's what is Caesar's. There's a certain debt that we owe to this world. And to live in this world without a burdening kind of debt provides us with a wonderful freedom, both in the present and into the future. So I highly recommend it. I'd like to read from Master's Discourse on the Bible. This one is Discourse 13, The Second Birth of Man and Spirit. It's a dialogue with Nicodemus. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of Jews. The same came to Jesus by night and said unto him, Rabbi, we know thou art a teacher come from God, for no man can do these miracles that thou doest, except God be with him. Jesus answered and said unto him, Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Master's comment. Nicodemus visited Jesus secretly in the night, for he feared social criticism. It was an act of courage for one of his position to approach the controversial teacher and to declare his faith in Jesus' divine stature. He reverently affirmed his conviction that only a master who had actual God communion could work the super laws that govern the inner life of all beings and all things. In reply, Christ forthrightly directed Nicodemus' attention to the heavenly source of all phenomena in creation, mundane as well as miraculous, pointing out succinctly that anyone can contact the source and know the wonders that proceed therefrom, even as Jesus himself did, by undergoing the spiritual second birth of intuitional soul awakening. The superficially curious crowds, attracted by displays of phenomenal powers, received only scantily from the wisdom trove of Jesus. But the manifest sincerity of Nicodemus elicited from the Master determined guidance that emphasized the supreme power and goal on which man should concentrate. Miracles of wisdom to the enlightened mind are superior to miracles of physical healing and subjugation of the nature. And the even greater miracle is the healing of the root cause of every form of suffering, delusive ignorance that obscures the unity of man, soul, and God. That primordial forgetfulness is vanquished by self-realization through the intuitive power by which the soul directly apprehends its own nature as individualized spirit and perceives spirit as the essence of everything. This is a wonderful, wonderful teaching that Master gives us here, because it goes to the source, and it takes us, all of us, to the source. There are many things that happened around Mother that were miraculous, and they happened continuously. I remember once that I was driving towards service. I was on Northgate Way, and I was thinking of God and thinking of coming to service, and suddenly there was a car that was stopped right in front of me, and I slammed on my brakes, and my van skidded toward the car, and I could tell by my speed and by how quickly that I was slowing down that I didn't have space enough before I had hit the back end of the car. And then suddenly it was as if somebody edited a film, and it jumped back a few spaces. And my car seemed to literally come back feet in the road. I continued to skid, and I continued to slide, but now I was able to stop with just inches to spare, as if perfectly timed. It was such an unusual occurrence that my mind could only grasp exactly what happened without any real explanation. But the truth is that the grace of a master goes out to all them who are inwardly attuned to that master. They are like a broadcast station. Now, a broadcast station for radio or television is a large tower that sends out a signal. And to any radio or television that attunes itself to that particular station can pick up the signals from a great distance away. And through that receptivity, they can listen to the talk or to the music or whatever is going on within that programming. Even so, a spiritually attuned master, and that is one whether they are in the body or out of the body, having a physical incarnation or having left this body, is still a broadcast station. And through our inner attunement, we are able to receive both the information and the power that comes from such a spiritually realized master. It explains how so many people can pray to Jesus, pray to Master, pray to Papa, pray to Mother, even though they're not in the body. And so very oftentimes they receive something very uplifting, even life-changing, in response for that inner attunement. Master used to emphasize the inner attunement as the way to really make progress upon the path. It is the ego mind that has determined that it is separate from God and conceives of God as something distant, if it conceives of a God at all. And oftentimes, the human mind projects onto God the very things that is of the human ego. So, God takes on the form of being vengeful or being jealous or those kinds of attributes that are really of a baser nature for mankind. The truth is that God does not punish out of vengeance. That if there is a plague that comes, if there is some form of destruction that comes to a society or to a particular area, it is not that God has suddenly decided to become vengeful and has reached out his hand to strike them down. Rather, God operates through his law, the law of cause and effect. And if we go against God and his law, either the law of nature or the law of spirit, then we will suffer the consequences. It's as simple as that. If you, as I have used the example before, were on a 10-story building and stepped off of the rooftop of that 10-story building, you would not say that gravity took vengeance on you and drew you to the ground at a rapid rate that would injure your body. You would say that's simply the law of gravity in operation, and you would be wise to observe it. Even so, the same is true with God. There are spiritual principles, there are spiritual laws that are universal. And we best learn what those spiritual laws are. Now, in the beginning, we learn it through the Ten Commandments, or the Yamas and the Niyamas of the Vedas. And through this, we learn to attune our mind to a higher consciousness. We learn to guide our lives, not driven by the human ego and by the senses and by our desire nature, but by what divine law instructs us to do. And so this is the human mind that is interrelating with the divine mind through the medium of the law. And there are some who put a great deal of emphasis on the law. But as is with the example in Jesus' life, when he was dealing with many of the Sadducees and the Pharisees of his time, they were strict observers of the law, but not the spirit of the law. They would do it with meanness. They would do it with an idea of putting people down and establishing their power. And when this is done, this is an absolute and total betrayal of anything that inspired the law in the first place. It is a betrayal of God and God within themselves. And there is a very great penalty for this. When you use the name of God and the idea of God, and you misuse it for personal, selfish purposes. Now, for many people, and many people who have been born into this world in recent times, there is a rejection of the God that they either grew up with in this lifetime, or through other lifetimes they grew up with, that was a projection of the human within. They were learned that God was vengeful. They grew up in fear. And they saw hypocrisy within church organizations. And they determined they didn't want anything to do with God. Now, this is unfortunate because they threw the baby out with the bathwater. It's true that hypocrisy is something to be abhorred. But it is not true that God has anything to do with that. And many times, people have gone through grievous situations, and they wonder why God abandoned them, why God didn't prevent something from happening, and so they get angry with God because he didn't stop something difficult from happening in their lives or lives of somebody that they knew. And this also is a misreading of the situation. This law of cause and effect reaches back very, very far. And sometimes things happen today that relate to something from a very long time ago, but the law must be worked out. As Jesus said, every title of the law must be worked out. And so we pay a price for those things that we have done, and sometimes we end up looking like an innocent victim, when in reality, if we were to see far enough back, we would see that there is a very refined law of cause and effect of exactly why things have happened in the way that they have. Now, there's a wonderful quote in this last journal from a great saint who was a disciple of Masters. And she said, "Lord, don't change my circumstances, change me. Now, Sister Gianna Mata was great friends with Mother. She is also from Seattle. And Mother knew her, as they were both co-disciples of a great master, Paramahansa Yogananda. And many times Mother went over to Sister Gianna Mata's house, and she had a wonderful library, and she opened her library up to Mother, who had very little money for any such things as these books. Particularly at that time, books from the East, books from India, were very rare and expensive. And so she opened herself to Mother, and Mother always felt great love for Sister. But that's a wonderful prayer. Don't change my circumstances, change me. And how oftentimes do we pray to God to change our circumstances, forget about me? It's like the Hildebrands. They made a determination that they were going to pay off this debt. They didn't make excuses. And they kept their commitment to God at the same time. And continuing on here with Master, all bona fide revealed religions of the world are based on intuitive knowledge. Each has an exoteric or outer particularity and an esoteric or an inner core. The exoteric aspect is the public image and includes moral precepts and a body of doctrines, dogmas, dissertations, rules, and customs to guide the general populace of its followers. The esoteric aspects includes methods that focus on actual communion with the soul of the soul with God. The exoteric aspect is for the many. The esoteric is for the ardent few. It is the esoteric aspect of religion that leads to intuition, the first-hand knowledge of reality. The lofty Sanatana Dharma of the Vedic philosophy of ancient India, summarized in the Upanishads and the six classical systems of metaphysical knowledge, and peerlessly encapsulated in the Bhagavad Gita, is based on intuitional perception of the transcendental reality. Buddhism, with its various methods of controlling the mind and gaining depth in meditation, advocates intuitive knowledge to realize the transcendence of nirvana. Sufism in Islam anchors on the intuitive mystical experience of the soul. Within the Jewish religions are the esoteric teachings based on the inner experiences of the divine, evidenced abundantly in the legacy of the God-illumined biblical prophets. Christ's teachings are fully expressive of that realization. The Apostle John's revelation is a remarkable disclosure of the soul's intuitional perception of the deepest truths garbed in metaphor. The elite traditions of Western philosophy and metaphysics laud the intuitional knowing power of the soul. The Greek mystic, the prophet, the philosophical philosopher, the mathematician Pythagoras, 580 BC, emphasized inner experiences of intuitive knowledge. Plato, born in 428 BC, whose works have come down to us as a primary foundation of Western civilization, likewise taught the necessity of supersensory knowledge to apprehend eternal truths. The Neoplatonic sage Plotinus practiced Plato's ideal of intuitively knowing reality. Quote, often I have woken to myself out of body, become detached from all else and entered into myself, he said, and I have seen beauty of surpassing greatness and have felt assured that then especially I belong to the higher reality, engaged in the noblest life and identified with the divine. He died exhorting his disciples, strive to bring back the God in yourselves to the God in the all. So these great mystics down through time, we can identify. Once your intuition begins to awaken, you go beyond the law, so to speak, because an inner law begins to operate through you. Now, we can't play fast and loose with this, and some people have. Well, God told me this, and God told me that. And off they go, sometimes on a fool's errand. and sometimes to the destruction of others. We can't play fast and loose with all of this, and yet we should not put God at a distance. We should feel that God is speaking to us, is operating through us, but we have to do the hard work to get there first. We have to learn how to make this mind still. And when the mind becomes very still, that intuition begins to open itself. We are then being born in spirit. We are born of water or of the body. And this is a wonderful opportunity to be born in spirit, because if you can accomplish this state of realization while here, then you can have that state and be established in that state wherever you are at, because this is one of the most difficult schools in which to accomplish such a thing. Now, you may think to yourself, why have I been put here? And why have I do I have to pass such a difficult test as to find God here? Why not make it easier? The truth is, your soul decided. It wanted this challenge. It wanted to go beyond the things of this body and the senses and the world. It knew what a terrific challenge, perhaps not in all the detail. You know, otherwise maybe we wouldn't have come. But we wanted that challenge. And when you think of that challenge and bringing out the strength inside of you, you see, we can look at things and we can stand back in horror and not want to enter into it. Or we can think, all right, God, you have made me fit for this challenge in some way, not through my own power, but through yours. And one of the great things that God showed me once is that difficult situations, when you use them in a spiritual way, make you grow so much spiritually, because you dig deeper for spiritual strength, for spiritual knowledge, for spiritual power. You realize the limits of your own. You realize that you need God. Now, this is not a neediness based on kind of a cowardly kind of way. Some people who have no understanding or faith in God think of people who believe in God as being weak, and therefore they need a God. The truth is, we all need a God. It's a universal principle. And that when we enter into this life, in order to really succeed, making contact with God first is an absolute must. Because we realize that of myself I am nothing. Because even those things that I declare as myself, as the egotist might, all of that has come as a gift, a wonderful gift from the divine. All your thoughts, all your ability to move in this body, to breathe, to think, to speak, everything comes as a flow of this life energy that comes directly from God. Now, what we do with that life energy determines whether we elevate our life or devolve this life. And we can do either. And so it's all based upon the decisions that we make. But to be born in spirit means that you become alive to this divine source that is, well, right within you. It is your life force. It is your intelligence. It is very core of you. Sometimes we look for God in such a way that the mind very cleverly makes God very distant. But to be born in spirit means to awaken to the divine life, even as it is flowing to you right now. Do not put conditions upon God and say, oh, God only exists if I experience Him as such and such. Only if I'm in a blissful state beyond all this world and this body will I think that this is God experience. God can come in all the ways that you experience life. God can come in pain in your body. He can come through a bewilderment and ignorance. It can come through a thought. It can come through an impulse. Everything inside of you is ultimately coming from the divine source. Now, it doesn't all resonate with that highest vibration. But when you, in your mind, reach back
and make that connection that this thought, this impulse, this feeling is coming from God. You constantly affirm that. You raise your consciousness up to that source of vibration. And if that thought is not in concert with God, it will lose its power. If you're having an impulse and you make that connection directly inside with God, and it's not of God, it will go away. It's a wonderful way to short-circuit the ego. You know, the ego can really have a grand time of it, thinking of itself as so low and so little, having nothing to offer, and look at what I have done. And it has a pity party of one, and it really has a good time of it. Nobody's ever been as bad as me. Nobody as weak as me. Nobody as ignorant as me. I must be the worst person in the world. Look at what a wonderful thing the ego does when it does such a thing. It completely isolates you from God. Now, it's wonderful only for the ego because it's a very great state of self-indulgence. And it doesn't really fit who you are in God. We have all fallen short of the glory of God, every one of us. And we have all made mistakes. Now, when an avatar comes into this life, perhaps they don't make any mistakes when they come in a completely God-tuned state. As Mother described, there are two types of avatars. One who comes in complete knowledge of who and what they are, and the other comes and is gradually awakened to that state, because in that way all humanity can identify with them and they can identify with all humanity. In the story of Ram and the Ramayana, Ram goes through various times when he's very despondent. He loses his wife, Sita. She's abducted and taken away. And he thinks that life is not worth living. Now, when you think that Ram represents the Kutasta Chaitanya, the divine consciousness at the sixth center, and that Sita represents the soul, and the soul is abducted by Ravana. Ravana takes Sita down south to Lanka. Now, Lanka represents the sexual base in the spine, and the soul has been abducted. And Ram pines for the soul, or divine consciousness pines for the soul, and say, oh, you've been abducted from me. What will I do without you? And it's really quite touching and very sweet when you think about God pining for the soul who's been abducted in this way. How far the soul feels from God at that time, and how much God yearns for the soul to return. Now, if you think, well, God is all-powerful, why doesn't he just demand that the soul come back? And the reason is because we have free will. And we can choose where we go to. We can choose the state that we're in. There's a funny, tragic story around that. There was a devotee of Mother's who got mixed up with some drugs and some other difficulties at one time and became mentally ill. And he came and he sat next to me, and one of Mother's lay ministers was giving a talk one time. And he said, you can choose whatever state you want to be in. And he's sitting there, and he's not in a completely normal state. And he says, well, California would be nice. He said, Arizona is good, too. And he's saying it rather loud, and people are snickering. And so I said, John, would you like to go out and have a cigarette? And he goes, yeah, Dave, I would. So we went out, and he had a cigarette, and we had our fun outside, so he wasn't disturbing everybody. And in truth, there are times when we have taken ourselves into such a state that we no longer have a choice, because in the moment, because we have fixed our lives in such a way that other forces take over. But we can begin to steer and direct ourselves in a way that will eventually lift us up, will begin to take us into a new state of consciousness. Now, it doesn't always happen in a moment. But we have to make a determination. We have to start now. We have to be like the Hildebrand story. You can imagine over $100,000 in debt and just how over the top that seemed to them. And yet, they made a determination to make these payments and to keep at it. And when we treat our spiritual life in a similar kind of way, we may have accrued some debts along the way. All right, let's pay off the debts. Let's get started. Let's get determined. And let's stay disciplined so that we can pay those debts off. And once having paid off the debts, then we can begin to enjoy the fruits of our labor. And it can seem unfair to us at times. If we're leading a spiritual life and others, people, are out having seemingly a great time of it, maybe we're going through kind of a rough time of it spiritually. We're having to face all those things that we did in our outward journey from God. Perhaps God is taking us through the mystical crucifixion. And it can be the greatest challenge that any human being has ever faced. And you can look out and you can think, and Mother said that she thought it herself. Sometimes I just wish that I hadn't even started on the whole thing. Her life was in such a way. And yet she stuck with it. And she didn't deviate to the left or to the right. And through that stick-to-itness, she persevered and she came through it. And as she oftentimes said, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. And if God asked me to go through it all over again, I would do it in a minute. Such is the great reward that I feel in having my state of God realization. So we have to be willing to pay the price. This is not something that goes down easily with some people. Some people just want a magic wand waved, and you just get it. You just have it. Now you think about Master's life with Sri Yukteswar, and it's interesting to read about, and it's tremendous to have such a great insight here. But you think about the pounding that Master took. Master would oftentimes bring his college friends around to see Sri Yukteswar. He thought so much of him, thought everybody else would too. And right in front of God and everybody, Sri Yukteswar would start in on Master. And Master, I think, probably thought that he had achieved a little bit of something by that time spiritually. And it was tough on him. It was tough to be taken down notches right in front of your friends. Here you're bringing them to see this great man of God. And you think one of the things that Sri Yukteswar asked Master, he says, promise me one thing. He said, you'll never avoid me. And Master made that promise and he kept it. And the thing is that you can just imagine, it would just be easier to stay away, wouldn't it? It would just be easier not to come. You could just kind of delude yourself into thinking that you're making spiritual progress without having made the commitment. There are many who do this. And true enough, in the moment, it's an easier road to go. But in the long run, it begins to show. And you don't make the spiritual progress because you're avoiding something. And when we avoid something, we can't help but put a brick in the wall that separates us between ourselves and God. And so you have to be willing to face those things that are most difficult for you. You have to be willing to go through everything that God asks you to go through. You can't say, well, God, I'm willing to do everything you ask me to, but don't do this. Don't embarrass me. Don't humiliate me. Don't do other kinds of things. I don't want to look bad in front of my friends. And just imagine the ego trying to make deals like that with God. It was an interesting thing that for years, my parents pretty much ignored my spiritual path. But my sister-in-law took initiation, and then my brother, and then my nephew. And by that time, my parents started getting a little worried. What's going on here? So they asked me if I'd be willing to talk to their minister at the Methodist Church there. And I said, certainly I would be. So they arranged for a meeting with him, and I went down and we spoke for a while. And after about 45 minutes of talking, he says, you know, I've been looking for something. something's been missing in my spiritual life, and I think this might be it. And so when I returned home, my father asked, well, he said, did you convert him or did he convert you? And I said, well, we liked each other very much. And he gave the thumbs up, so it allowed my parents to relax their hold a little bit. They were getting a little anxious. And so, of course, they were filled with goodwill. They only wanted what was the best. And so, but sometimes God puts us in positions where we have to stand up. Now, Nicodemus came at night because he felt embarrassed, because it was difficult, because Jesus was controversial, because Jesus said, I and my Father are one. Now, many times, because we've not been schooled in history very much, we don't realize that the Messiah, there was nothing implied in the tradition of the Messiah coming again that implied that it was God who would reincarnate. Rather, it would be a great leader of Israel who would lead them out of bondage and reestablish the political state of Israel once again. And so this idea, this notion that I and my Father are one was really very troublesome to many people. And ultimately, according to the story, it's what Jesus was crucified for. And in this is the symbol within us. Can I accept that God is within me? Or do I always conceive of myself as being separate from God, and God is out there someplace? As Sri Yukteswar said, do you conceive of him as being some bearded man in some antiseptic corner of the universe? Can you imagine that God is dwelling within you, speaking within you, flowing through his life force within you? You see, this is being born again in spirit. This is what it means to become awakened in spirit versus sleepwalking through this life, unaware of the divine consciousness. I was working with an individual the other day, and she's more from a psychological standpoint than spiritual, but of course you can't really separate the two. And she was doing the work, and suddenly she felt a tremendous force come from behind her head and move her head forward, and she just felt this power flowing through her medulla and through her brain. And she said, what is this? She had no knowledge about it. You see, these things are not something that's produced by the mind. They are real experiences that happen to us as we attune ourselves to God. And that force will come into you, and it'll begin to change and transform you. And where it will take you to, you cannot tell, other than it will take you to God. That's the only thing that you know for sure. It's the only thing that you know for sure. So we have all come together for this purpose. As Master said, the outer stories are for the masses, you might say. Those are the people who are not yet ready to learn about the inner story or the esoteric story. That is for the few. And so we are the few who have come together in order to develop ourselves. Now, this is not a one-time thing. It's not like you have one God experience and, oh, okay, that's it. And you walk off and feel like a satisfied customer. This is something that is for your lifetime. And it is an experience that you look for and purify yourself until there is nothing left. That's why we continue to come together. It's not a one-time shot. It's something that we can grow into, and it's a wonderful thing when you think about it, that you can have your oneness with God, but you always are growing in God consciousness. There's never a time when you stop growing unless you completely merge yourself with the one divine consciousness. But as long as you have any sense of individuality at all, you will always be growing in God. Because God is infinite, and that's not something to be underestimated. It's not something that you can just label out there and put on a box and say, okay, I'm done with that. It is an ever-present living life right within you. So to be born again doesn't mean going down to an altar and accepting Jesus as your Lord and Savior, and, well, that's that. Okay, now I'm just going to go back and try to live a good life. It's so much more than that. That's the outer symbol. But the inner reality is much, much different, much more powerful, and much more wonderful. Jesus said, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." That's no small thing, and from a human standpoint, it's impossible. But in God, you can sense and know His perfection. And through constant communion with His perfection, your life is perfected. So wake up. Awake, arise, and come into your God self. Do not settle for peanuts when you can sit at the banquet table and dine with the masters of all time. Isn't that thrilling? Isn't it thrilling? Somebody the other day asked me the meaning of the chant, Om Shri Ram. Om, of course, is the name, the vibration of God that goes out through all creation, and you hear it at the back of your head as a high-pitched sound that comes in, and I hear it even as I'm speaking to you now. And it comes in through the medulla, through the back, the base of your skull, comes into the brain, and you can trace it, just as you can trace any kind of physical sensation. You can trace it. You can feel it coming into the brain, being distributed throughout the brain, and then flowing down through the spine and throughout the centers of the spine and then out through your body. So that is the Om. Shri is honored, is beautiful, is wonderful. And so it's an adjective of honor. And Ram is the name of God, both in the personal and the impersonal. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram. Jai is victory. Victory. Let that be victorious in my life. Let it be victorious in my consciousness. Let it change me, never to be the same again. You're welcoming in God and the vibration of God. And so let us chant that name just for a little bit here. Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ramo. Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ramo. Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai. Jai Jai Ram Om. Sri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om. Sri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om. Sri Ram Jai 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 Ramo. Please join with us in person or in spirit this Tuesday for the fall equinox, 22nd. We're going to have meditation. I think that's also going to be on the Skype or the telephone as well? Okay.
Just
a conference call through the telephone if you want to join us that way, or through your own inner telephone, the internet within your own system. And also then on the 3rd, is it that we're going to have potluck in Kirtan to mark the anniversary of Swami Satchidananda's 1 year since his Mahasamadhi. And that'll be Saturday evening, and you can get the details from Carla. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Victory to God, victory to the light. May you be blessed with his presence. May he awaken himself within you more and more and more until you are consumed in that presence. And you realize that there is no longer an I and a thou, but there is only one, only one. And no service here next week?
No service next week.
Okay.
So appreciative to have you all here, and I know we're in cramped spaces, but I really appreciate your flexibility. When Larry and I decided to buy this property, and we talked about what would we do for service, because we knew we were going to be in this little place, I got the image of being at an ashram and Swamiji being there in this little hallway room that he would sit in sometimes, and all these people would come in, and I remember sitting a number of times, you know, with all these women pressed against me. And if I shifted my knee, there'd be bodies around it, and you're all kind of just sitting in there. But the and it's 90 degrees. so I thought about how we all came together there to see that wonderful saint, and I thought we can all come here to see our wonderful saint, and we're sitting on chairs. so then it was confirmed that we should continue on having us.
Thank you for opening your home. But it's wonderful, I think, to meet in homes. And in India, you see it very particularly that people have a puja room in their home. And that's their primary place of worship. They go to temple now and then, mostly for special occasions, not on a weekly basis in the way that we do. And then they go to see gurus and teachers for their teachings. But the primary source of their worship and their love for God is right within their homes. And I think that's a wonderful thing. So this emphasis on the householder yogi and holding services in the home, it changes the vibration of the home, but it also sends out the message, the home is the place of God. The family is the place of God. Ramakrishna used to say, fight the battle from the fortress. And by that he meant by the family home. You don't have to go out into some remote cave. You only need to learn how to turn the mind within and find God right where you're at, and not deny the benefits of that from your family and your loved ones. Besides, I've stayed in caves before, and it's no picnic.